who will be arguing for each side?
I'll be arguing for who is taking the honor. My name's Andrew Music.
Okay.
I'll be arguing Norman Thomas for Mr. Chamberlain.
And I know y'all have been here for a while, so I see that there are no sign-in sheets left, so I assume they've all been signed. You have 15 minutes. You can reserve time for rebuttal. Given that there is cross-error, we may be pretty... To the extent we get into it, we may give you some additional time.
At this juncture, I will just reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right. As you may have heard, I will try to remind you, but it is your responsibility.
Understood.
Whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. Well, good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. At first blush, this may appear to be yet another abstruse tracing case about streams of money winding their way through various different financial accounts, generating thousands of pages of financial records about the testimony of CPA witnesses.
I think on that, everybody can agree. So we...
But appearances can be deceiving. This appeal implicates issues, first and foremost, of fundamental fairness. The principle that a litigation be conducted fairly was especially critical in this case because there are vast disparities between the two parties. I'll refer to my client as Katya and the husband as Ted, as did the appellee in their brief. The two parties have vast disparities of resources, of money, and sophistication between them.
So isn't that fundamentally why parties, and I appreciate that the trial court decided to set aside the prenup, but that's why parties enter into prenup where there is what may be considered a disparity in income, disparity in earning ability, and the like. And the trial judge went through the process and, to your advantage, set aside the prenup, but then went through, from what I can discern, a pretty exhaustive review of how to figure out to put these parties in an equitable situation based on the circumstances presented, and you seem to quarrel with that. Why
we're
is
not
that?
Really challenging the equities of their decision. We're really challenging their as regards their our assignments of error regarding equitable distribution. They're more in the nature of challenges to the trial court's classification of property, which is an error of fact. But fairness in this case.
But and therefore you have a really, really high burden.
I will acknowledge that, Your Honor, the relevance. but fairness in this case requires that both parties have access to the same information and documents, that complex expert reports not be sprung on the other side mere weeks before trial, and that the opinions of
Let's talk for a minute about that. One of your big contentions is that the trial court erred by accepting the testimony of Mr. Rosenberg. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Did your client ever request a continuance when the report came in late?
She did not, Your Honor.
She did not. Okay.
The case had been continued once before.
And when Mr. Rosenberg was about to be called, there were at a hearing shortly before then, there's a discussion. And how do I read the we withdraw the objection to him testifying? I mean, aren't you bound by that? I mean, at that point, at least, he's going to testify.
And I realize that the transcript is a little confused on this point. But Katya did not withdraw her objection. She withdrew objection on the basis of the expert's non-disclosure. They had actually, in fact, filed their designation of expert witnesses. That fact became apparent to us only at the trial. It had been mailed but never received by us. So we withdrew our objection only to that limited extent.
Okay, but so that allows him to testify about the matters on which he was disclosed to testify, consistent with the disclosure.
But we did not withdraw our objection to the untimely provision of his expert's report.
Okay. But if he gets to testify, he can testify to everything in the report, whether the report's admitted to or not, and in fact, did. And so, to the extent that there could ever be an issue with an alleged untimely production of the report, how could that be anything more than a harmless error?
Katya withdrew her objection on the basis of that, of the fact that he wasn't designated. She did not withdraw her objection on the basis that his report was provided late. She reserved argument on that. The trial court took up argument on that.
My reading of the transcript is the only objection to his testimony that she preserved at the time at that point in time was, we have objections regarding hearsay. It wasn't, we have objections regarding hearsay and for things that weren't disclosed to us in what we consider a timely fashion.
I think the transcript, Your Honor, actually is kind of a multi-aspect objection, Your Honor. She preserved that during
can you point out to me where?
Page 2014 of the appendix.
Can you read specifically what was said at that juncture?
I unfortunately do not have it.
I think your colleague has something for you. Okay. Why don't you move on while she's getting that for you? I think the concern that all of us have as we're looking at this is that it sort of gets bollocksed up a little bit, in that obviously the expert was allowed to testify, and apparently there was some basis in which you agreed that he could testify. As I understand the argument, and please correct me if I misstated, is that you don't have any problem with the expert testifying, but the expert's testimony must be material and must rely on something that's appropriately admissible. And your position is that the information that was provided by your opponent colleague's client formed the basis for the testimony for the expert witness, and that information thus became hearsay because it was an out-of-court statement off the truth of the matter asserted therein. Is that it?
That is one of our assignments of error.
Okay.
Regarding the expert report and the expert designation issue, you didn't cite to the Supreme Court's most recent case on this, Mikhailov versus Sales, which notes, going back to John Crane, that whether an opinion has been sufficiently timely disclosed is reviewed on a pure abuse of discretion standard. In Sales, the court said the trial court, by allowing the opinion, abused its discretion because the opinion was never disclosed. Here, your argument is it was disclosed. It was disclosed 2 weeks before trial.
Yes, sir.
And it seems to me that takes you out of the Sales exception, and then it's just a pure, did the trial court abuse its discretion?
On that assignment of error, Your Honor, I concede that that is the correct standard of review, and we did challenge it. We did allege that it was an abuse of the trial court's discretion to admit that recording to evidence, permit him to testify, just notwithstanding the untimely disclosure of his report.
And perhaps you're not pursuing this. There's a suggestion that he shouldn't have been allowed to testify because you weren't provided certain documents in discovery.
That's correct, Your Honor. That was one of our grounds in our motion in limine.
My understanding is from the record, and it appears there are numerous sites to it, that your client was and counsel was given the opportunity to review those documents or to review documents at opposing counsel's office and never took that opportunity. Is that correct?
I think counsel, Your Honor, went back and forth on this. It reduced to an invitation. He alleged that Katya's counsel was essentially welcome at any time to come into his office and review those documents. And
if that invitation were extended, if we accept that is true, wouldn't that satisfy any obligation under Rule 4:9 to produce documents for inspection and copying?
I think it has to be a genuine invitation, not just an open standing invitation. It has to be come at this particular point in time.
Did Katya ever, or counsel ever, take them up on the offer?
She did not, because to the extent it was not a genuine offer. They didn't set aside a particular point in time.
As I understand the offer, as you've characterized it, it's you can come anytime you want to, just let me know. And you never test that. How can you say it's not a genuine offer? If she had said, I want to come next Thursday at 2, no, you can't do it. I want to come, then you might be able to say it's not a genuine offer.
I think it would be improprietous just to walked out to his door.
I would think you would call first and say, okay, I'm coming over to view the documents. Is that okay?
Our position is it's just not a genuine offer. This case has been pending for...
But she never tested the offer in any way?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
Counsel, we don't want to try to take up all your time. We may give you some additional time to sort of work through some of the other issues. But can you tell the court how you believe that the trial court used an inappropriate mechanism for tracing what might be considered marital property, separate property, or hybrid property?
Pursuant to the touchstone case on this issue, which is Rabarin versus Rabarin, tracing is a two-step process. First, tracers must establish the identity of the separate portion, and second, they must directly trace that portion to a separate interest. And further, they must prove each component of a multi-step transaction.
And it seems in this case, if we apply that standard, and I appreciate you articulating the standard, if we apply that standard, the way that it would happen practically is that the individual who holds the majority of the assets would speak with an accountant or an expert of some sort and say, all right, when I had this particular house, I sold it and I used that money to buy this particular house, and then I had this car, and when I sold this car, I used that money to buy this boat. In other words, all this property I had beforehand, and I was just moving designations of items of property that I had. And it seems, as I understand the record here, that the expert listened to your opponent colleague's client, and that's how they figured out what money went where. Where do you think the trial court missed the boat in applying that test that you just articulated?
They just didn't adduce evidence to every link in that tracing chain. They skipped in the introduction of any evidence concerning those intermediate steps. They basically asserted that, well, it came from, we believe it to be, they basically introduced speculative evidence as to the ultimate source of money.
But then when we came to that point, and I hear you when you say that, but when they came to that point, there was a suggestion in the record that you, on behalf of the client, didn't have anything to contest what determinations they had made.
This is all presumptively marital property. I don't think it's in dispute that this was all property that was acquired during the marriage, and pursuant to the Virginia Equitable Distribution Statute, is presumptively marital property.
If everything that Ted said about the various pieces of property, the various pieces of accounts, if all of that is accepted as true, what's not sufficiently traced?
He did not delineate the intermediate steps, the steps that the journey essentially that the money took from its beginning in a separate asset, a separate source, to becoming a presumptive.
But like for the boat, he says, I took this money and I bought the boat.
We didn't challenge the boat, Your Honor. For example, page 3515 of the appendix concerning certain 2006 deposits made into UBS account number 073, which I believe was one of the largest items of property disputed among whose classification was disputed among the parties. But for $146,000 worth of deposits made into that account during the marriage, this was the sum total of Ted's evidence, based on discussions with Ted and amount assumed to be ASI distributions. He did not directly trace those distributions to the presumptively marital property as is required under the holding of Rabarin. He basically classified those distributions based on a presumption because
I've got another tracing question for you, but you're deep into your rebuttal time, and we're going to give you some extra time because I'm confident Mr. Thomas is going to tell me that we shouldn't reach any of this and we should go on prenup. So you can either sit down or take my question now.
I will sit down.
Okay.
May it please the court, Your Honor. My name is Norman Thomas, and I represent Ted Chapin. I'm here with Mr. John Cadden, who also represents Mr. Chapin, and represented him at the trial court level. There's two truths that Katya ignores, in effect, with respect to the tracing issues. One of them is that Ted testified that all of the marital salary, which never exceeded $36,000 as gross in any year that they were married, but all of that was subsumed in household expenses, every bit of it, and there was no rebuttal to that. and the only other source of liquidity was his ASI distributions. There was no other money from which it could come. Therefore, there's no marital source from which it could come.
Well, I'm sorry. Counsel, you agree that when it comes to issues of tracing, your client bears the burden of proof.
There's no question that he bore the burden of truth, the burden of proof in tracing. However, when it comes to the marital funds, they were all, and this is the second point that they're ignoring, the Sandy Spring 1006 checking account. That was Ted's before the marriage. It was stayed in Ted's name all through the marriage. And although it received the marital salaries that then went for household expenses, by operation of 20-107.3A3D, to the extent the marital funds went into that separate account and lost their identity, they were transmuted to Ted's separate funds. So that's the other truth. They're all the
What authority do you have to suggest that it was transmuted to Ted's separate funds when you have obviously a commingling of both marital and separate property?
Well, it was his separate account.
Right.
And Virginia Code Section 20-107.3A3D, that subpart D, holds that very rule. And the Moran versus Moran case, which we cited, and also the Zaluski case, and I'll give you the sites of those cases right here, stand for that proposition. Actually, I don't have the sites of that, but Moran versus Moran and Zaluski versus Zaluski. Zaluski is an unpublished case, but I found it on Lexis. And Moran versus Moran is definitely
29 Virginia App 408.
Yeah. And what that says is if marital funds are placed, in effect, into an account that was a separate property account, and they're commingled with separate property such that the marital funds lose their identity, then it's transmuted into the receiving classification, that is, the separate property.
The marital funds become separate property rather than the separate account becoming marital property.
Yes. Now, that's the operation of the statute. But it's also important to remember that Mr. Rosenberg had every single statement from Sandy Spring 1006 checking account from the beginning to the end. And he traced those to Ted's separate property
And when the request for production came in, although the rules providing them for inspection is enough, generally the request for production comes in and says, please produce at my office, the requesting party's office, the following documents. Was there a formal response to that discovery request that was, we're not going to produce them there, come look at them?
There were there were thousands of documents that were produced to them. And then with respect to other documents, and there's no, something that Katya never did. She never did differentiate fully between what was in fact sent to her and what wasn't in fact sent to her to give the trial court an opportunity to do anything other than recognize, number one, that they didn't go and look at the documents that they were invited to come and see. And with respect to the continuance, Ted invited the continuance in his response to the motion in limine to exclude Mr. Rosenberg's testimony. He said, as alternative relief, we produce thousands of documents to them, they have no complaint, but as an alternative, if they feel prejudiced, let them ask for a continuance.
Counsel, if we could go back, and I'm looking at your section, the code section that you referenced, 20-107.3A, and it says, when marital property and separate property are commingled by contributing one category of property to another, resulting in the loss of identity of the contributed property, the classification of the contributed property shall be transmuted to the category of the property receiving the contribution. Here's the hook. In applying 20-107.3A3D in the context of marital property which receives contributions of separate property, this court has held that the totality of the commingled property is presumptively marital. The burden for tracing any separate interest and therein rests squarely on the party claiming such interest.
That's exactly what Mr. Rosenberg did. Ted testified that all toll funds that went into that account from this very low salary.
The $36,000.
It went down to 26 in subsequent years. All of that was spent on household expenses.
Except how, once they're commingled in the account, how do you, I mean, money is fungible. I mean, it's not like you have marked bills and, you know, there's that Voya commercial where some of the money is orange and some of the money is green. Once money starts coming in and out of the account, how can you say that the $36,000 went to household expenses, which were far greater than $36,000? So we know both types of money were coming out of the account. How can you say that the marital salaries was the money that came out of the account?
Two ways. One, if you look at the statute, the receiving account was Ted's account. It was his before, during, and after. So the account that was receiving it by operation of this statutory rule that transmutes the commingled funds was separate property. So that's our position on that. Alternatively, and in addition, Mr. Rosenberg looked at all of the statements, and his expert opinion was corroborating of Ted's testimony that everything that was received in salary went to household expenses and everything else purchased was through his ASI funds.
Well, yeah, but hypothetically, I have $100,000 in the account, and we get $36,000 in marital salary that goes in the account, so we have $136,000. And $45,000 goes out for household expenses. That's what the bank statement can show me. That's all the bank statement can show me. If the money is deposited, resides in the account, and then goes out. It doesn't say this 30, unless you specifically signed over the check for the $36,000 to somebody, you have $100,000 in the account, now you have $136,000 in the account, $45,000 goes out. How do I know that the 36 was what went out as opposed to the 100?
Ted testified to it, and the judge believed it.
So theoretically, then, if you have a separate account, and let's use Judge Russell's example of $100,000, and it was clearly separate property acquired prior to the marriage, and all of the money that you earned during the course of the marriage, you ran into that separate account. From a theoretical basis, if someone comes in and testifies, yeah, all the money that I put in was used for, that money that was used during the course of the marriage was actually the marital property and was only separate property that was still retained in that account. Wouldn't that leave you with an unusual result where a person could basically run all the money into a separate account and then get the benefit of that?
Whether it's unusual or not, perhaps. But
that wouldn't be equitable, though, would it? It wouldn't be fair.
Your Honor, the law is what it is. And Ted Chapin testified that all of that money was used for household expenses. Katya's testimony was that she never had anything to do with the finances.
But if we do that, I can see, if we were to hold that, I could see many people in the domestic relations bar saying, okay, if I've got the party that has the most assets, I'm going to make sure that I run everything into a separate account, because if I do and I can get someone to testify that the marital portion of that was used for marital purpose and everything else was separate, I can insulate what would be arguably marital property from an accounting in the context of equitable distribution.
Well, Your Honor, there are nefarious calculating people in this world. I don't mean to be trite about that.
Yes, sir.
But every case is case by case, and this one was decided on its facts in that regard. I would like to speak for a few minutes, if I may, about the prenuptial agreement. We start off...
You may even get an extra moment or two if you need it.
All right, thank you. We start off with the proposition that these agreements are favored under Virginia law. When Virginia adopted the Uniform Premarital Agreement Act, now about 31 years ago, they became favored under Virginia law, and a challenging party bears a heavy burden as a matter of law to present clear and convincing evidence that it should be set aside.
As unconscionable.
Correct. Uh-huh. Now, the judge found it was unconscionable when it was entered, but this case was decided on whether Ted made a fair and reasonable articulation of his assets.
Okay, before you get to the next point, is unconscionability a question of fact or a question of law?
Well, Your Honor, whether it's unconscionable or not,
yes, sir,
is already established in this case. I'll say that first. But it's looked at by the court, I believe, as a matter of fact. Now, the unenforceability under the statute is a matter of law by virtue of the statute.
But you have not challenged the unconscionability finding in this appeal, and your point is for it to be unenforceable under A2, that's only one factor.
There has to be an absence of a fair and reasonable disclosure. And our position is that Katya never met her burden to establish that it wasn't a fair and reasonable disclosure, and the majority rule says so.
And I understand your materiality argument, and I have some questions for your opponent on that. But here we have $500,000, as Judge Hupp characterized it, in liabilities that were never disclosed. No liabilities disclosed.
They were omitted.
Okay. And maybe to various people, $500,000 isn't a lot. Still a lot to me. That's a pretty significant number in absolute terms.
In absolute terms, yes, Your Honor.
And given that there was no disclosure of liabilities, none, why isn't that significant?
All right, I'd like to make 2 points there. First of all, bear with me for this hypothetical. If he disclosed $1.795 million in assets and didn't owe but $50, well, if you undertake the strict liability test that the trial court did here, then because he forgot those $50, this thing is over.
And I understand that, and but $500,000 is a lot bigger than $50.
That's true. It's a glitzy number, and it got repeated a lot in Koch's briefs. And yet, look at it from this standpoint. And this is the context of the majority rule. The majority rule, in effect, holds that did one party provide the other party sufficient information about their financial condition to enable them to make a rational decision regarding whether to enter the premarital agreement?
Is it the premarital agreement or the marriage?
Well, it's the premarital agreement.
Okay. If a party could argue, when I thought he was worth 1.7, I wanted to marry and was willing to sign. At 1.2, I'm not.
Well, that's an argument that, and I don't, well, let me say this. At no point on brief and in their argument that they just made in front of you did Katya ever contend that she lacks sufficient information about Ted's financial condition to make a rational decision regarding whether to enter that agreement. And in fact, what you have here at 1.8 versus 1.3, Ted presented himself to Katya as a well-to-do man of 61 years old who possessed $1.8 million in assets. That is well over $1 million in assets. And she knew that's what she was giving up when she voluntarily entered this agreement. What's the residual information after you net out the liabilities? Ted was still, on November 20, 2001, a well-to-do man of 61 years old who possessed well over $1 million in assets. And that goes to the materiality. And that's why the majority rule of all the jurisdictions that have adopted this act is what it is. There's no strict liability. There's a relativity argument and a relativity consideration that must be made.
And I understand that. I guess my one concern here is there was no disclosure of liabilities. And I understand the materiality argument, and it may not be material given the amount of the assets. But with no disclosure, can't the trial judge go, you gave nothing? And we're not talking about $50. We're talking about a big chunk of change.
The court could have, well, I'll put it this way. The court could not correctly say that because this amount of money in relation to what was disclosed was not a sufficient amount. Although, it's agreed, it's a lot of money.
It's more than 25% of the estate.
It's right around there. But at the same time, may I continue?
Yes.
Did she have sufficient information based on the residue of, in other words, did she have sufficient information at $1.3 million net value to make a rational decision regarding whether to enter?
Isn't that a finding of fact that the trial court makes?
Actually, Your Honor, on contested facts, we do give a great deal of weight to the trial court opinion, but the application of the facts to the rule of law is a de novo determination. And the Anthony case that we cited in the brief demonstrates that it's a question, as a de novo question for this court, in looking at this situation and determining whether it was a fair and reasonable disclosure. And our position is that it was, because she possessed the requisite amount of information to make a rational decision whether to enter the agreement. And the fact that, again, this isn't assets, importantly. This is not assets that have been somehow squirreled away or omitted. This is liabilities. And if you look at the residue of information, it was still sufficient information about his financial condition to give her all the information she needed to make a rational decision.
If our review of everything leads us to the conclusion that Judge Huff applied what you would call the strict liability standard, and we conclude that that was error, that it's not strict liability, that there is some non-absolute quality to the necessary disclosures, what's the proper remedy? Is that for us to decide, or do we send it back to him to decide under the particular facts and circumstances?
Right, Your Honor, this is a de novo review as a matter of law. If this court deems it a fair and reasonable disclosure, that's the end of the matter. There's no additional facts to be taken at the trial court level. They've had their record, and that's our position. They have not met clear and convincing burden as a matter of law.
I'm trying to conceptualize what you're saying here, and I appreciate your argument. It's a very good argument. Essentially, a prenuptial agreement is a contract. We agree with that. It's basically a contract.
Yes, sir.
And any time, and if we go back to law school, a contract requires consideration on both sides, correct? And if you don't get full disclosures to what the consideration is, doesn't that really go to the heart of the contract and the ability of the parties to actually come to a meeting of the minds as to how they're going to resolve the issue?
It depends on the materiality. And that's our point. It's not a strict liability standard. It depends on the materiality.
But how can we discern what may be material to one of the contracting parties?
Your Honor, it's a matter of the articulation of the majority rule. It says, was there sufficient information provided to her about his financial condition to allow her to make a rational decision? And here on this record, Your Honor, we say very much it was. And that's where it's not a subjective test, as Katya has said, but the argument, according to that rule of law, does apply to say if she would sign away $1.8 million, she would have signed away 1.3.
But let me take you in a circle that we kind of get ourselves caught up in. She could have gone into it and said, okay, look, I know that the person that I want to marry has a net worth of $1.8 million, and I know that he gets paid this $36,000 a year from this company that he works for. And so, therefore, I have reason to believe that $36,000 that he earns over the course of our marriage would be something that I would get the benefit of. However, because now he only has $1.3 million in assets, there's less money that we can live off. So now that $36,000 that I thought I was going to be an equal partner in is now subsumed because he has to use that to pay for our marital expenses. You see how the argument gets sort of circular?
Well, two things.
Yes, sir.
First of all, it's a bit of a hyperbolic argument.
Yeah, I'm good at those.
Yes, sir. Credit where credit is due. But what happened in this case?
Mm-hmm.
What are the facts? The record shows he loved her. He took good care of her. On page 38 of their brief, they acknowledge that his ASI earnings were in excess of $200,000 a year. These folks went to every state in the lower 48 during the 9 years of their marriage. That's them doing. They took their child out of public schools and private schools homeschooling so they could do that type of traveling. As Katya said, that was a relaxed lifestyle. In her pretrial filing, she said it was a lavish lifestyle. So what really happened, she got the benefit of that money.
You are...
I'm way over time. I've never had such leave granted. Thank you, Your Honors.
Don't tell anybody.
and we will give you an extra 5.5 as well. I was going to give 5, but Mr. Thomas took an extra 30 seconds. So.
A couple of points in response, Your Honor. Just to clarify on the issue of the invitation to come and view documents, I believe the record reflects that that Ted's trial counsel never called Katya's trial counsel back or emailed her back. I think
Can you tell me what page that's on?
I had this all on my smartphone. I was just going to pull it up, but it ran out of batteries.
That's all right.
Continue with your argument. Yeah.
To Ted's second point, he alleges that because page 2008 of the appendix, Your Honors, Katya's trial counsel in argument to the court states, and then I called twice, which I did not receive a return call, so there are documents he hadn't provided.
Well, what about the argument that you didn't, that there's been no specification of which documents were provided and which ones weren't, which, as the party who did not prevail below, it's your burden to show us what happened?
I think you can discern that from evidence in the record. That's best shown by looking at the schedule of documents relied on by Ted's expert witness. It enumerates a list under the heading responses to production of documents. It enumerates a meager handful of documents. Everything else was what we requested in discovery, but were not, and that was responsive, and that Ted was obligated to provide to us in response to discovery duly propounded on him, and that Katya did not receive. That's how to test.
Tell me how the failure to disclose a lessened amount of assets at $1.3 million as opposed to the $1.8 million, which was disclosed, was disadvantageous to your client from a contractual circumstance.
That's essentially reading words out of the statute. The statute is written in the negative disjunctive. It requires a fair and reasonable disclosure of both assets and liabilities.
Well, right, but fair and reasonable by its very nature, it is amorphous. And the one thing it is, by adding the words fair and reasonable, it's clear that absolute disclosure was not necessary. Because if not, then you would just say a disclosure of property and obligations.
And I don't think it can be credibly contended that the failure to omit, that a disclosure which omitted $500,000 of liabilities, again, 25% of the estate at the time, is in any sense of the word fair and reasonable.
Well, I guess the question is, a majority of the states do appear to have adopted a materiality standard under, can you frame me any argument in which somebody would be willing to have signed 1.8, no liabilities, I get nothing, but wouldn't have signed 1.8, $500,000 in liability, I still get nothing?
I think, given the circumstances,
because when we talk about materiality in contract, it would be something that would prevent her from signing the contract, that would have changed her conduct. What about that would have changed her conduct?
No,
is there any evidence?
I think Hockey would have put whatever was, under the circumstances, she would have signed whatever was put in front of her. She was at the time of the marriage, she was a 27-year-old, penniless, virtually non-English-speaking Russian immigrant. She would have essentially signed.
But that's a different argument. That's duress, and we're not talking about duress here.
She would have signed whatever was put in front of her, and that the statute incorporates objective standard so that.
So the $500,000 would not have affected her at all. I guess my question is, can you come up with an objective person who would have been willing to sign $1.8 million in assets, no liabilities, I get nothing, but wouldn't have been willing to sign $1.8 million in assets, $500,000 in liabilities, you still get nothing? I mean, it seems to me that anybody who's willing to sign contract one would almost certainly sign contract two, but maybe I'm missing something.
I think that the knowledge of the full knowledge of somebody's responsibility, the extent of their obligations could affect their decision to enter into a contract.
But in the, but we have the parameters, and it's 1.8 versus 1.3.
But that could, I mean, that could affect things. I mean, that could affect future. That those claims, those liabilities, could affect her entitlement, their ability to enjoy future fruits of the partnership.
I think the only way, counsel, that you're going to be able to get there is to suggest some sort of detrimental reliance. And what detrimental reliance would you suggest here?
Circumstances change. Assets are assets. Liabilities, they can become claims. Assets can diminish. Liability can then become claims on those diminished assets or on future fruits of the partnership. That's still essential information.
If we were to adopt your position, would the following be an insufficient disclosure? I have $100 million in assets. I have $1 million in liabilities. I disclose $500,000 in liabilities, but for some reason forget, leave out a piece of paper. And so we have $100 million in assets and $500,000 in undisclosed liabilities.
We're not arguing for a strict liability.
Right. I'm asking, under your interpretation of the statute, would that be sufficient or potentially sufficient?
I would concede it could be potentially sufficient, but that's not the case here. This was $500,000 of undisclosed liability. Again, almost 25% of the estate at the time. If he hadn't disclosed, $10, $100, $1,000, we wouldn't be here. It was $500,000.
And make sure I understand your point. You're essentially conceding that the strict liability standard for the assessment of this prenuptial agreement would not be an appropriate standard for us to use.
I don't think that's the standard that the trial court applied.
Okay.
If I can read from his decision, he said, Virginia Code 20-151 requires a fair and reasonable disclosure of financial obligations of that party. Here, it turned out that the husband had approximately $500,000 in liabilities that were not disclosed. That implies that an objective standard is implicit in that holding. It's simply that under no sense of the words fair and reasonable could a disclosure which omitted $500,000 ever suffice.
Well, although you seem to agree with at least my hypothetical where there was $500,000 that wasn't. But I will end on this question. Do you agree with what appears, and first you can tell me if you disagree, it's the majority rule, but do you agree that what appears to be the majority rule of states that have the Uniform Act and or have similar language, that fair and reasonable is a materiality standard? And if not, what is it?
I would first take issue with Ted's characterization of his urged construction as a majority rule. I don't think the out-of-state precedents he cites in support in any way add up to a majority rule.
Okay.
But I do believe there is a materiality standard.
Fair and reasonable is materiality.
Yes. In this case, it was clearly $500,000 of liabilities in an estate that's worth $1.8 million on its face is material. That holding, that standard was implied in the trial court's decision.
And materiality is generally a question of fact.
Yes, Your Honor.
No.
I'll give you another 30 seconds to wrap up if you want it.
I'll just close briefly on the fees. The last assignment of error was the trial court's failure to award Katya fees. We think the circumstances and equities of this case militated in favor of a substantial award of fees to Katya. First of all, there's a great disparity in the parties in terms of resources. And second, Katya incurred the level of fees as she did primarily as a result of Ted's failures in discovery.
Thank you. We'll come down and recounsel.
All right.